heard small arms fire, I wondered if it was his and Zamui's last stand. I awoke the next morning to loud wails from Rosina's quarters. I ran into Ghosh and Hema in the corridor, and we went rushing out in our pajamas. Gibru and two somber men stood outside Rosina's door. Her hysterical wailing was in Tigrinya, but its meaning would have been clear in any language. We learned that General Mebratu's small group had escaped up into the Entoto Mountains and then circled back into the lowlands near the town of Nazareth. They were headed to Mount Zikwala, a dormant volcano, where they hoped to shelter on land belonging to the Mojo family. In the end, it was peasants who betrayed the general with loud cries of Lulululu when they stumbled on his group. A police force soon surrounded General Mebratu. In that last firefight, running out of ammunition, the general disarmed a wounded policeman, then crawled to another wounded policeman to get his weapon. He called to Iskinder, his brother, to help, but instead, Iskinder shot our beloved general in the face before putting the gun in his own mouth. I wonder if they had made a suicide pact, or had Iskinder made a decision for the two of them. As for Zamui, father of Genet, friend of Darwin, he refused to surrender or to take his own life. He charged the forces that had him surrounded, and they gunned him down. Iskinder's bullet had hit the general's cheek and ripped out his right eye, leaving it dangling before lodging under the left eye. By some miracle, the bullet did not enter the skull. The general was unconscious but alive. He was rushed to the military hospital in Addis Ababa, a distance of about 100 kilometers. We sat around the dining table, the four of us, trying to block out the wailing from Rosina's. I could hear Genet's sobs from time to time. Though Hema had gone in and come out of Rosina's quarters, I couldn't bring myself to do so. Shiva had his hands over his ears, and his eyes were moist. While we were still huddled at the table, Mr. Loomis's office called. "Business as usual," Ghosh said, putting down the phone. Loomis town and country was open, and if we were Tuesday House, we had to remember to bring our sports gear. Despite our misgivings, Ghosh convinced us that school would be better than listening to Rosina's wailing all day. He drove us there, Shiva and I sharing the front seat. Near the National Bank, a crowd spilled off the sidewalk, into the street, charged with a strange energy, heading toward us. We inched forward. Suddenly, I saw directly in front of us, as clearly as if they were on a stage, three bodies strung up on makeshift gallows. Ghosh told us to look away, but it was too late. In their immobility, the corpses appeared to have been dangling there for centuries. Their heads were angled awkwardly, and their hands lashed behind their backs. The crowd swarmed around our car. The festivities were apparently just over. One young man walking with two others slapped the hood of our car, the sound making me jump. He grinned, and whatever it was he said, it wasn't nice. Someone else slammed the roof above our heads, and then we felt our car rock back and forth. I was sure the mob would string us up by our necks, too. I clutched the dashboard, a scream in my throat. Ghosh said, "Keep calm, boys. Smile. Wave. Show your teeth. Nod your head. Make it look as if we came for the show." I don't know if I smiled, but I do know that I stifled that scream. Shiva and I grinned like monkeys and pretended we weren't frightened. We waved. Perhaps it was the sight of identical twins, or the sense that we were just as crazy inside the car as they were on the outside. But we heard laughter, and the thumps on the car were now more good-natured, less violent. Ghosh kept nodding his head, a big smile on his face, waving, keeping up an agitated chatter. I know, you unkempt rascal. Good morning to you too, yes, indeed. I have come to delight in this heathen spectacle. Let's hang you, by Jove. It certainly is most civilized of you to do this. Thank you, thank you. And inching forward. I'd never seen him this way before, expressing such dangerous contempt and anger under a smiling and false exterior. At last we were through, the car moving freely. Looking back, I could see hands tugging at the leather shoes of the corpses. Shiva and I had arms around each other in our ancient pose. We were badly shaken. In the school parking lot, Ghosh turned off the engine and held us to him. I wept for Zamui, for General Mebratu, shot in the eye, for Genet and Rosina, and at last for myself. To be in Ghosh's arms and against his chest was to find the safest haven in the world. He cleaned my face with one end of his kerchief and then used the other end on Shiva. That was the bravest thing you might ever do in your lives. You kept your head. You screwed your courage to the sticking place. I'm proud of you. I tell you what, we'll go out of town this weekend. To the hot springs in Sodere or Waliso. We'll swim and forget all about this. He gave us each a final hug. If I find Mekonnen, then he'll be here with his taxi the usual time. If I don't find him, I'll be here myself at 4. When I was about to enter my classroom, I turned back to look. Ghosh was still standing there, waving. Loomis town and country was abuzz. I heard boasts of what the other kids had seen and done. I felt no desire to contribute or listen. That day, while we were in school, 4 men in a jeep came to visit Ghosh. They took him away as if he were a common criminal, his hands jacked up behind his back. They slapped him when he tried to protest. Hema learned this from W.W. Gonad, who told the men they were surely mistaken in taking away missing surgeon. For his impertinence, W.W. got a boot in his stomach. Hema refused to believe Ghosh was gone. She ran home, certain that she'd find him sunk into his armchair, his sockless feet up on the stool, reading a book. In anticipation of seeing him, in the certainty that he would be there, she was already furious with him. She burst through the front door of our bungalow. Do you see how dangerous it is for us to associate with the general? What have I been telling you? You could get us all killed! Whenever she came at him like that, all her cylinders firing, it was Ghosh's habit to flourish an imaginary cape like a matador facing a charging bull. We found it funny, even if Hema never did. But the house was quiet. No matador. She went from room to room, the jingle of her anklets echoing in the hallways. She imagined Ghosh with his arm twisted behind his back, being punched in the face, kicked in the genitals. She ran to the commode as her lunch came up. Later, she lit incense, rang the bell, and vowed that she'd make the pilgrimages to the shrines at Tirupati and Velankani if they released Ghosh alive. Hema picked up the phone to tell Matron, but the line was dead. The phones had stopped working when the bombs fell, and ever since, they had only worked sporadically. She stood looking out the kitchen window. Ghosh's car was at the hospital. But even if she got in the car, where was she supposed to go? Where had they taken him? And if she went and they arrested her as well, then her sons would be left alone. It took a monumental effort of will for her to decide to wait for us. Hema could hear a sobbing monologue from the servants' quarters. The voice was Rosina's, though it was hoarse and sounded nothing like her. It was addressed to Zamui, or to God, or to the men who killed her husband. It had begun that morning, and it had not reached its zenith. Hema saw Genet emerge, red-eyed but composed, leading a wobbly Rosina. They were heading for the outhouse. They had no one to mourn with them other than Almaz and Gibru, who at that moment were elsewhere. Hema felt that Genet had aged suddenly, that a hardness had crept into the little girl's face, and the sugar and spice and everything nice had died. Hema splashed water on her cheeks. She took a deep breath. It was crucial that she stay calm for our sakes, she told herself. She drank a glass of water that had passed through the purifier. She had just put the glass down when Almaz came running in.
Madam, don't drink the water! They are saying the rebels poisoned the water supply!
But it was too late, because Hema felt her face burning, and then came the worst belly cramps of her life. Chapter 26 The Face of Suffering. When Gibru met us at the gate and said men had come and snatched Ghosh from missing, my childhood ended. I was 12 years old, too old to cry. But I cried for the second time that day, because it was all I knew to do. I was not yet man enough to sweep into the house of whoever had taken Ghosh away and rescue him. The only skill I had was to keep going. Shiva was ashen, silent. For a brief moment I felt immensely sad for him, my handsome brother who had reached the height of a teenager without shedding the rounded shoulders of boyhood. His eyes reflected my pain, and for that instant we were one organism, with no separation of flesh or consciousness. And we ran as one being, the twins, up the hill, frantic to get home. We found Hema on the sofa, pale, sweaty, wet strands of hair sticking to her forehead. Almaz, her cheeks tear-stained and looking nothing like the stoic Almaz we knew, was by Hema's side, holding a bucket.
"She drank the water," Almaz said before we could ask. "Don't drink the water!"
"I'm all right," Hema said, but her words were hollow. It wasn't all right. How could she say it was? My worst nightmare had come true. Ghosh, gone. And now Hema, mortally ill. I buried my face in the darkness of a sari, my nostrils filled with her scent. I felt responsible for it all. The general's ill-fated rebellion, Zemui's death, the arrest of a man who was more father to me than any man can be, and yes, even the poison in the water. Just then the front door flew open, and Matron and Dr. Bocelli ran in. Bocelli carried his well-worn leather bag, his chest heaving. Matron, also gasping for breath, said,
"Hema, there's nothing wrong with the water. It was just a rumor. It's all right."
Hema looked confused.
"But I've had cramps, nausea. I threw up."
"I drank it myself," Bocelli said. "There's nothing wrong with it. You will feel better in a few minutes."
Shiva looked at me. A glimmer of hope. Hema rose then, testing her limbs, her head. Later, we found out that similar scenes were playing out all over the city. It was an early lesson in medicine. Sometimes, if you think you're sick, you will be. If there was a god, he had just given us a huge reprieve. I wanted another.
"Ma, what about Ghosh? Why did they take him? Will they hang him? What did he do? Is he hurt? Where did they take him?"
Matron sat us down on the sofa. Her bright handkerchief came out.
"There, there, little loves. We'll sort this out. We all need to be strong, for Ghosh's sake. Panic does not serve us."
Almaz, silent till then, watching with her hands on her hips, interrupted to say in Amharic,
"What are we waiting for? We have to go at once to Kercheli prison. Let me get the food ready, and we need blankets, clothes, soap. Come on!"
The Volkswagen felt like a strange machine with Hema driving.
Bocelli sat up front, and Almaz and Matron were in the back seat with us on their laps. We made our jerky way through the city. I saw Addis Ababa anew. I had always thought it a beautiful city, with broad avenues in its heart and many squares with monuments and fenced gardens around which traffic had to circle. Mexico Square, Patriot Square, Menelik Square. Foreigners, whose only image of Ethiopia was that of starving people sitting in blinding dust, were disbelieving when they landed in the mist and chill of Addis Ababa at night and saw the boulevards and the tram track lights of Churchill Road. They wondered if the plane had turned around in the night and they were in Brussels or Amsterdam. But in the aftermath of the coup, in the light of Ghosh's arrest, the city looked different to me. The squares which commemorated the bloodshed of Adowa and the liberation from the Italians were now fitting places for a mob to conduct a lynching. As for the villas I had once admired, pink, mauve, tan, and hidden by bougainvillea, it was in these houses that men like the general or his counterparts in the army and police plotted the revolution and its betrayal. There was treachery in the streets, treachery in the villas. I could smell it. Perhaps it had always been there. Soon we were at the green gates of the prison everyone called Carcere, a corruption of the Italian word carcere, or incarcerate. Others called it the Alembecagne, an Amharic expression that meant goodbye, cruel world. The entrance was past a railway crossing on a busy trunk road. There was no pavement here, no shoulder, just asphalt falling abruptly off into dirt. Dirt now stirred by the feet of hundreds of anxious relatives who became our kin in suffering. They stood rooted in their helplessness, but they let us pass between them till we reached the sentry office. Before Matron could ask, the man said without looking up,
"I don't know if he or she is here. I don't know when I will know if he or she is here or not here. If you leave food or blankets or whatever, if he or she is here, they might get it. If not, somebody else gets it. Write his name on the paper with whatever you are dropping off, and I will not answer any questions."
People leaned against the wall, and women stood under umbrellas unfurled out of habit, even though the sun was behind clouds. Almaz found a spot to squat where she could observe the comings and goings, and then she did not budge. An hour passed. My feet ached, but still we waited. We were the only foreigners there, and the crowd was sympathetic. One man, a lecturer at the university, said his father had been in this jail many years ago.
"As a boy, I would run the 3 miles from my house once a day to bring food. He was so thin, but each time he would feed me first and make me take back more than half the food. He knew that for him to eat, we had to starve. One day, when my older brother and mother came with food, they heard the dreaded words, 'No need to bring food anymore.' That's how we knew my father was dead. And you know why they arrested my brother today? For no reason. He is a hard-working businessman, but he is the child of one of their old enemies. We are the first suspects, the old enemies and the children of enemies. God knows why they spared me. I was in the demonstration by the university students, but they took my brother instead, because he is the oldest."
Bocelli took a taxi to the Juventus Club to see if he could get the Italian consul involved, and then he had to return to missing. With one doctor arrested and his wife waiting outside the jail, it all rested on the shoulders of the third doctor, namely Bocelli. He could keep things going, oversee the nurses and Adam, the compounder. Shiva, Hema, Matron and I returned to the car to rest our feet, to get warm, to huddle. After 15 minutes, we returned to stare at the gates. Back and forth we went, reluctant to leave, even though we were accomplishing nothing. When it was quite dark, a man with a shama covering his head, mouth, and upper torso walked by, just as we emerged from the car. But for his shiny boots and the fact that he'd come from the narrow lane on the side of the prison, he might have passed for just another man heading home. In his hand, he swung a cloth showing the outline of a covered pot, his lunch or dinner. He stared at Matron. He paused behind the car, his back to the road as if he were taking a leak.
"Don't turn this way,"
he said harshly in Amharic.
"The doctor is here."
"Is he all right?" Matron whispered.
He hesitated.
"A little bruised, yes, but he is fine."
"Please, I beg you," Hema broke in.
I had never heard her beg anyone in my life.
"He's my husband. What is going to happen next? Will they let him go? He had nothing to do with all this."
The man hissed. A large family walked by. When they passed, he said,
"Talking to you is enough for someone to accuse me. If I want to be safe, I must accuse someone. Like animals eating our young. It's a bad time. I'm talking to you because you saved my wife's life."
"Thank you. Is there anything we can do for you, for him?"
"Not tonight. In the morning, at 10 o'clock, be in this spot. No, be farther away. See that post with the street light? Be there, and bring a blanket, money, and a dish just like this. The money is for him. Go home now."
I ran over to fetch Almaz, who had not left her spot, her voluminous skirts ringed around her like a circus tent, her white gabi wrapped around her head and shoulders, only her eyes showing. She wouldn't hear of leaving. She was going to stay the night. Nothing would persuade her. Reluctantly, we left her, but only after we forced Almaz to put on Hema's sweater and then wrap herself with the gabi. At home, mercifully the phones were working. Matron got the British and Indian embassies to promise to send their envoys in the morning. None of the royals would talk to Matron. If the emperor's own son was under suspicion, so were his nieces, nephews, and grandchildren. We heard that there were rumblings of discontent among the junior army officers who felt their generals erred in not joining the coup. There must have been some truth to that, because that day the emperor authorized a pay raise for all army officers. The word was that only the intense rivalry and jealousy between the senior army and imperial bodyguard officers had saved His Majesty. That night, Shiva and I slept with Hema in her bed. Ghosh's brill cream scent was on the pillow. His books were piled on the nightstand with a pen wedged in French's index of differential diagnosis to mark a page, and his reading glasses balanced precariously on the cover. His bedtime rituals of inspecting his profile and sucking his belly in and out 10 times, of lying across the mattress for a few minutes so his head hung back over the edge, anti-gravity maneuvers, as he called them, were unexciting, but in his absence, their importance was revealed.
"Another day in paradise,"
was his inevitable pronouncement when he settled his head on his pillow. Now I understood what that meant. The uneventful day was a precious gift. The three of us lay there and waited as if he'd just gone to the kitchen and would fill the doorway any second. Hema sobbed. She voiced our thoughts when she said,
"Lord, I promise never to take that man for granted again."
Matron, who'd decided to sleep in our house, in the bed that belonged to me and Shiva, called out,
"Hema, go to sleep now. Boys, say your prayers. Don't worry."
I prayed to all the deities in the room, from Muruga to the bleeding heart of Jesus. In the early morning, Almaz was back. There'd been no news.
"But I stood up whenever a car came and went. If the doctor was in the car, I wanted him to see me.
Hema and Matron planned to go to the arranged spot at 10 o'clock, carrying food, blankets and money. Then they'd make the rounds of the embassies and the royals. Hema convinced us to stay at home.
What if Ghosh calls home? Someone needs to be here to take the message.
Rosina and Genet were there, so we weren't completely alone. Almaz, after rejuvenating herself with bread and hot tea, insisted on going back to Kachele with Hema and Matron. By noon, they were still not back. Shiva, Genet, and I fixed sandwiches while Rosina looked on, distracted. She was red-eyed and hoarse.
"Don't worry," she said. "Ghosh will be all right."
Somehow, her words weren't reassuring. Genet, pale and strangely listless, squeezed my hand. Kuchulu was the kind of mutt who rarely made any noise. At missing, barking at strangers would have been a never-ending proposition. So when I heard Kuchulu bark, I paid attention. Looking out of the living room window, I saw a scruffy man in a green army jacket stroll up the driveway and disappear behind our house. Kuchulu turned rabid, unleashing a volley of deafening yelps. Her message was, "A very dangerous man is at our doorstep." I ran to the kitchen where Rosina, Genet, and Shiva were already at the window. Kuchulu was just below us, loud as I had ever heard her. She moved forward, her neck disappearing in a collar of raised fur, her teeth bared. The man pulled open his heavy jacket and drew a revolver which was tucked in his pants. He had no belt, no holster, and no shirt, just a white vest. At the sight of the gun, Kuchulu fled. She was brave, but not stupid.
"I know him," Rosina whispered. "Zumui gave him a ride a few times. He is army. He used to stand just outside the gate, hoping Zumui would come by. He was always flattering Zumui. Envy is behind flattery," I told Zumui. "Zumui would pretend not to see him, or he'd tell him he was going in another direction."
The army man tucked the gun back into his pants. Then he walked over to the BMW and caressed the seat.
"See? What did I tell you?"
Rosina said.
"Come out, please," he called, looking our way. "I know you're in there."
"Stay here,"
Rosina said, drawing a deep breath.
"No, don't stay. You all go by way of the front door and run to the hospital. Wait with WW. Wait till I come for you."
She threw the bolt back.
"Lock the door behind me,"
she said as she stepped out. I cannot tell you why the three of us, instead of obeying her, simply opened the door again and followed her. It wasn't bravery. Perhaps the notion of running away felt more dangerous than staying with the one adult we could count on. The intruder's eyes were bloodshot, and he looked as if he'd slept in his clothes, but his manner was jocular. The bulky camouflage jacket was big enough to swallow him, and yet his arm stuck out of the sleeves. He was missing his beret. He had a dark vertical furrow in the middle of his forehead, like a seam where the two halves of his face met. Despite the scraggly mustache, he looked too young for his uniform.
"This," he said,
almost spurring as he stroked the motorcycle tank,
"belongs to the army now."
Rosina pulled her black shama over her hair, the gesture of a woman entering a church. She stood silent and obedient before him.
"Did you hear me, woman? This belongs to the army."
"I suppose it is true,"
she said, eyes downcast.
"Perhaps the army will come and get it."
Her tone was deferential, which is why her words took a few seconds to sink in. I wondered later why she chose to provoke him and put us at risk. The soldier blinked. Then he exclaimed in a high-pitched voice,
"I am the army!"
He grabbed her hand and yanked her to him.
I am the army!
Yes, yes. This is the doctor's house. If you are taking anything, you should let him know.
The doctor?
He laughed.
The doctor is in jail. I'll let him know when I see him again. I'll ask him why he hires an impertinent whore like you. We should hang you for sleeping with that traitor.
Rosina stared at the ground.
Are you deaf, woman?
No, sir.
Go on. Tell me one good thing about Zemui. Tell me.
He was the father of my child,
Rosina said softly, refusing to look him in the face.
A tragedy for that bastard child. Just tell me something more. Go on.
He did what he was told. He tried to be a good soldier, like you, sir.
A good soldier, huh? Like me.
He turned to us, as if asking us to witness her impudence. Then, so quickly that none of us saw it coming, he backhanded her. It was a tremendous blow, sending her reeling, and yet somehow she didn't fall. She held her shama to her face. I could see the blood. She brought her feet together and stood upright. Shiva and I instinctively clasped hands. I felt something wet running down my shin. I wondered if he'd notice, but he was preoccupied with a nasty gash on the knuckle of his middle finger. I could see a flash of white, either sinew or tendon or a tooth fragment.
The devil! You cut me, you cap-tooth bitch!
Out of the corner of my eye, I saw Genet moving. I knew that look on her face so well. She flew at him. He raised his foot, caught her in the chest, and pushed her off before she could get near him. He pulled out his gun again, cocked it, pointed it at Rosina.
Do it again, bastard child, and I'll kill your mother. Do you understand? Do you want to be an orphan? And you too,
he said, addressing us.
Stay out of my way. I could kill the lot of you right now and I'd get a medal.
We all recognized the plastic keychain that he pulled from his pocket. It was in the shape of the Congo. There was only one like it in our world, and it belonged to Zemui. In getting the motorcycle off its stand, he almost fell over. After straddling the bike, he looked around for the lever and, finding it, he tried to kick-start the engine. But the bike was in gear, and so it lurched forward, almost toppling him. When he got his balance, he looked to see if we'd noticed. He tromped on the pedal, trying to find neutral. It was such a contrast to Zemui, who merely towed the lever and who handled the BMW as if it were feather light. Zemui would prime the cylinders with a slow-motion stroke, followed by a brisk kick, and the motor would chug into life. Thinking of Zemui, who'd fought to the death rather than surrender, I felt ashamed. It made me want to act in a manner befitting the bike's true owner. I squeezed Shiva's hand. Shiva Marion was on the same page, I could tell, because he squeezed back. The soldier flailed at the kickstart lever as if he were stomping an enemy, his face getting flushed, sweat pouring off his brow. I smelled gas. He'd flooded the carburetor. It was a cool day, the sun filtering through a few clouds and glinting off the chrome of the motorcycle. He paused to get his breath, then took off his jacket, slung it on the seat behind him. He shook out the hand with the bloody knuckle. He was a scrawny, thin fellow, I saw. Annoyed and humiliated by the engine resisting him, his lips drew back in a snarl. His frustration was dangerous.
Let us push it for you. You flooded the engine, and that's the only way to start it now.
This from Shiva.
When you get to the bottom of the hill, just put it in first gear, I said. It'll start right away.
He looked over, surprised, as if he didn't know we were capable of speech, let alone in his mother tongue.
Is that how he started it?
He never ever flooded it, I wanted to say.
Every time, I said,
especially if he hadn't started it for a while. He frowned.
Okay, you two help me push the motorcycle.
He shoved his gun deeper into the waistband behind his belt buckle. He tucked the jacket that he had thrown over the seat under his buttocks. From the top of our driveway, the gravel road leading down to Casualty started off flat and then descended and seemed to disappear over a ledge, beyond which one could see the lower branches of trees that were just within the perimeter wall. Only when you were halfway down did you see how the road turned sharply, well before the ledge, and then went on to the roundabout near Casualty.
Push! He said. Push, you bastards!
We did, and he helped by leaning forward and walking the machine. Soon he was rolling, licking his lips, happy. The bike weaved, and the handlebars made wide excursions.
Steady!
I called. Shiva Marion was pushing in unison, a three-legged trot that soon became a four-legged sprint.
No problem,
he shouted, putting his feet on the pedals.
Push!
We gathered speed on the downslope.
Open the gas cock! Open the valve!
Shiva called out.
What? Oh, yes,
he said, and he took his right hand off the handlebars to feel for the petcock under the tank, precious seconds ticking away.
It's on the other side,
I shouted. He switched hands. He'd never find it, and it didn't matter because there was enough fuel in the carburetor to take him at least a mile. The bike was traveling at speed now, springs squeaking and mudguards rattling, its weight accelerating it down the hill, aided by our efforts. He'd taken his eyes off the road to find the petcock. By the time he looked up, Shiva Marion was running as fast as it could, adding every ounce of thrust possible to his progress. I saw his white-knuckled grip on the throttle, while his left hand was undecided whether to continue its search or return to the handlebars.
Put it in gear, quick!
I shouted, giving the bike a last desperate push.
Full gas!
Shiva yelled. He was slow in responding, first twisting the throttle all the way, then glancing down to stamp on the gear lever. For a heart-stopping moment when it slipped into first, the bike seized, the back wheel locking. We had failed. And just when I thought that, the engine sputtered and roared to life, revving to its red line with a vengeance, as if it were saying, I'll take it from here, boys. It surged forward, the back tire spitting gravel at us, nearly throwing the rider off, which only made him cling harder, squeezing the throttle in a death grip instead of letting go. A howl emerged as he saw what was ahead. He had only a few feet and a few seconds to negotiate the turn before the ledge. It is an axiom of motorcycling that you must always look in the direction you want to go, and never at what you are trying to avoid. His gaze, I was sure, was fixed on the approaching precipice. The BMW roared ahead, still accelerating. I raced after him. The front wheel hit the concrete curb at the ledge and stopped. The back wheel flew up in the air, but for the weight of that big engine, the motorcycle would have somersaulted over. Instead, it was the rider who sailed past the handlebars, his howl now a scream. He flew in an arc, shooting over the ledge and then falling until his motion was arrested by a tree trunk. I heard a whoomp, an involuntary grunt as the air in his lungs was evicted. His momentum snapped his neck forward and smashed his face into the tree. He tumbled down and rolled another 10 feet. The BMW, after standing on its nose, fell back to the ground and onto its side. The engine stalled, but the back wheel kept spinning. I had never heard such silence. I clambered down. I got to him first. I'd wanted this to happen, but now I felt terrible that it had. Amazingly, he was conscious, flat on his back, blinking, stunned, as blood trickled into his eyes and poured out of his nostrils and lips. There was no more army in him. His expression was that of a child whose reach had exceeded its grasp with disastrous results. His foot lay twisted under him in a fashion that made me want to throw up. He moaned, clutching at his upper belly. His face was a bloody mess. It was a grotesque sight. Neither his face nor his foot seemed to concern him as much as his belly.
"Please," he said.
His breath was short, and he clawed at his belt. His eyes found me.
"Please, get it out."
For a moment, I'd forgotten what he had done to Zemui, or Rosina and Genet, or what he'd done to Gauche. All I could see was his suffering, and I felt pity. I looked up to see Rosina, her lips swollen and split, a front tooth missing.
"Please," he said again, clutching at his chest. "Get this out! For the love of Saint Gabriel, get this out!"
"I'm sorry," I said. He kept rooting ineffectively, desperately at his belly, and now I could see why. The pistol butt was digging into him. It had just about disappeared under his ribs on the left side.
"Watch out!" Rosina yelled. "He's trying to get his gun!"
"No," I tried to say. "The gun handle has smashed in his lower ribs." I did hear myself say to him, "Hold on, I'll get it out." I wrapped my hands around the handle of that gun and pulled with all my strength. He screamed. It would not budge. I changed my grip. I felt a mule kick in my hand before I heard the shot. Then the gun came sliding free in my hand, as if it had never been wedged there, but had simply been sitting on his belly button. I smelled burned clothing and cordite. I saw a red pit in his belly. I saw life slip out of his eyes as easily as a dewdrop rolls off a rose petal. I felt his pulse. It was a variety Gauche had never shown me. The absent pulse. Rosina sent Genet to fetch Gibru. He came running. He hadn't heard the shot. The bungalow was far enough removed, and the gun so muffled by the man's belly that the sound had not carried.
"Hurry! Someone might come for him," Rosina said. "But first we must move the motorcycle."
With all five of us heaving, we righted the BMW and managed to get it to the tool shed, just past the curve at the bottom of our driveway. Other than a ding on the tank, the bike looked no worse for wear. In the tool shed, we arranged the cords of firewood, the stacks of Bibles, the sawhorse, incubator, and other junk kept there, so that the bike was hidden from sight. Returning to the body, we had little to say to one another. Gibru and Shiva fetched the wheelbarrow, and with Rosina and Genet's help, they fed the body into its rusty cavity. I leaned against a tree, looking on. He lay in the wheelbarrow in the kind of unnatural posture only the dead achieve. Now with Rosina leading us, we pushed him through the trees on the perimeter trail, just inside of Missing's wall, until we reached the drowning soil. The hospital's old septic tank was located here, deep underground, and for years it had overflowed before it was taken out of use. USAID Concrete, Rockefeller funds, and a Greek contractor named Achilles had built a new one. But the old tank's effluent had digested the land. A downy growth of moss served to deceive the eye. Anything heavier than a pebble would sink. The odor, present at all times, kept trespassers away. Matron had barbed wire strung around it, and the sign in Amharic said drowning soil, which was the closest translation for quicksand. The smell was powerful. Pushing down the fence post so that the barbed wire was flat on the ground, Rosina and Gibru got the wheelbarrow as far forward as they dared. I glared at Shiva. He was impassive, looking on. He could have been watching shoeshine boys at work. it was the opposite of what I felt. They were about to pitch the body forward when I said, "No!" I grabbed Rosina's hand, forcing her to set the wheelbarrow down. I was shaking, crying. "We can't do this. It is wrong. Rosina, oh my God, what have I done?" Rosina slapped me hard. Shiva put his hand on my shoulder, more to restrain me, perhaps, than to offer support. Rosina and Gibru took the handles again, and they tipped the dead man out. The mossy ground sagged like a mattress. The face on that body no longer belonged to the man who had terrorized us. It was a pathetic face, a human face, not that of a monster. When the body finally disappeared, Rosina spat in its direction. She turned to me, the anger and bloodlust contorting her face.
"What's wrong with you? Don't you know he would have killed us all for the fun of it? The only reason he didn't is he was even hungrier to steal Zamui's motorcycle. Don't feel anything but pride for what you did."
We walked back in silence. When we were home, inside the kitchen, Rosina turned to us, her hands on her hips.
"No one but us knows what happened," she said.
"No one can know. Not Hema, not Ghosh, not Matron. No one at all. Shiva, you understand? Genet? Gibru?"
She turned to me.
"And you? Marion?"
I looked at my nanny, her face bloodied and the missing tooth making her look like a stranger. I steeled myself for more harsh words from her. Instead, she came over and held me in her arms. It was the hug a woman gives either her son or her hero. I held her tight. Her breath was hot in my ear as she said,
"You are so brave."
This was my consolation. All was well between me and Rosina. Genet came over and put her arms around me. If this was what brave felt like, numb, dumb, with eyes that could see no farther than my bloody fingers and a heart that raced and pined for the girl who hugged me, then I suppose I was brave.
Chapter 27 Answering Medicine. Hanging seemed to be the fate of anyone who'd been close to General Mebratu. What spared Ghosh thus far was that he was a citizen of India. That and the prayers of his family and his legions of friends. His imprisonment did more than suspend everything in my world. It took away any meaning life once had for me. It was then, as we despaired, that I thought of Thomas Stone. Before the coup, I'd go for months without thinking of him. Having no picture of him, and no knowledge that he had authored a famous textbook, Hema, I learned later, had given away or removed every extant copy of A Short Practice at Missing. Thomas Stone seemed unreal to me, a ghost, an idea. It didn't seem possible that I might have been fathered by someone as white-skinned as Matron. An Indian mother was easier to imagine. But now, as time stood still, this man whose face I couldn't picture was on my mind. I was his son. This was my moment of greatest need. When the army man came to steal the motorcycle and could have killed us, where was Stone? When I murdered the intruder, that was still how I saw it. Where was Stone? When the death mask loomed in front of my eyelids at night, or when the cold hands clutched at me from the shadows, where was Stone? Above all, when I needed to free the only father I ever had, where was Stone? In those awful days which soon stretched out to 2 weeks, as we went back and forth from house to jail, to Indian embassy, to foreign ministry, I was convinced that had I been a better son to Ghosh, if I'd been worthy of him, I might have spared him his present torture. Perhaps it wasn't too late. I could change. But what form should this change take? I waited for a sign. It came on a blustery morning when word of fresh hangings in the Mercato reached us. I set out hurriedly for the gate for no particular reason. Wherever I was ready to be somewhere else. On my way there, a mysterious sweet, fruity odor reached my nostrils. Simultaneously, a green citron, floating on its shocks, its back tires hidden by skirt-like fenders, wheezed into the portico of casualty. A portly man slumped in the back seat was carried out by two younger men, and at once the scent got stronger. He had the café au lait skin and jowly features of the royal family, as if he had been raised on clotted cream and scones in place of injera and wort. To me, he looked asleep. His breathing was deep, loud, and sighing, like an overworked locomotive. With every exhalation he gave off that sweet emanation. It even had a color. Red. I knew I'd encountered this odor before. Where? How? I stood thinking outside casualty as they carried him in, trying to solve this puzzle. I realized I was engaged in the kind of reflection, the kind of study of the world which I so admired in Gauche. I remembered how he'd conducted that experiment with blind man's buff, literally a blinded experiment to validate my ability to find Genet by her scent. Later, Dr. Bocelli told me the man had diabetic coma. The fruity odor was characteristic. I went to Gauche's office, his old bungalow, and read from his textbooks about the ketones that built up in the blood and caused that scent. Which led me to read about insulin, then about the pancreas, diabetes. One thing led to another. It was perhaps the only time in the 2 weeks since Gauche had gone to prison that I had been able to think of anything else. I expected Gauche's big books to be unreadable, but I found that the bricks and mortar of medicine, unlike, say, engineering, were words. You needed only words strung together to describe a structure, to explain how it worked, and to explain what went wrong. The words were unfamiliar, but I could look them up in the medical dictionary, write them down for future use. Hardly 2 days later, I encountered the scent again at Missing's Gate. This time, an old woman stretched out on the bench of a gharry, propped there by her relatives, was the source. She had the same sighing, breathing, and not even the horse's strong scent could conceal the fruity odor. "Diabetic acidosis," I said to Adam, and he said it was possible. The blood and urine tests confirmed that I was right. Somehow, life went on at Missing. Whether we had one doctor or four, the patients kept coming. The simple things, treating dehydration in infants, treating fevers, conducting normal deliveries, were routinely managed. But anything surgical had to be turned away. I hung around casualty with Adam, or else I hid in Gauche's old bungalow, browsing through his textbooks. Time didn't speed up, nor did my fear for Gauche diminish one bit. But at last I felt I had found something that was the equivalent of Shiva's drawing or his dancing. A passion that would keep disturbing thoughts at bay. What I was doing felt more serious than Shiva's pursuits. Mine felt like an ancient alchemy that could cause the prison gates in Kercelle to spring open. During that awful period with Gauche in jail, Almaz holding vigil outside prison, and the Emperor so distrustful of everyone that Lulu had to sniff every morsel of His Majesty's food, my olfactory brain, the feral intelligence, came awake. It had always known odors, the variety of them, but now it was finding labels for the things it registered. The musty ammoniacal reek of liver failure came with yellow eyes and in the rainy season. The freshly baked bread scent of typhoid fever was year-round, and then the eyes were anxious, porcelain white. The sewer breath of lung abscess, the grape-like odor of Pseudomonas infected burn, the stale urine scent of kidney failure, the old beer smell of scrofula. The list was huge. One night after supper, Matron dozed on the sofa while Shiva drew intently at the dining table. Hema, who was pacing the room, stopped by my armchair. This was Ghosh's spot. I had my feet up and books piled next to me. I think she understood that I was preserving his space. Over my shoulder, she saw the thick gynecology textbook of hers that I'd opened, purely by chance, to a picture of a woman's vulva distorted by a giant Bartholin cyst. I made no attempt to hide what I was doing. I sensed Hema's struggle to find an appropriate response. She put her hand on my hair, and then the hand slipped down to my ear, and I thought she was going to twist my pinna. That's what I learned the fleshy part of the ear was called. I felt her indecision. She caressed my pinna and stroked my shoulder. When she walked away, I felt the weight of what she left unsaid. I wanted to call after her. Ma, you have it all wrong. But just as she kept her thoughts to herself, I was learning to do the same. This was what growing up was about. Hide the corpse. Don't bare your heart. Do make assumptions about the motives of others. They're certainly doing all these things to you. I'm sure Hema believed that a prurient interest in a woman's anatomy took me to that page in the textbook. And perhaps it did, but that wasn't all there was to it. Would she believe me if I said that those musty old books with their pen and ink drawings, their grainy photographs of people parts contorted and rendered grotesque by disease, held out a special promise? Kelly's obstetrics, and Jeff Goat's gynecology, and French's index of differential diagnosis, at least in my childish way of thinking, were maps of missing, guides to the territory in which we were born. Where but in such books, where but in medicine, might our conjoined, matricidal, patrifugal, twisted fate be explained? Where else could I understand the urge in me? Was it homicidal? I'd lie awake at night wondering. That did away with the army man, and then the simultaneous urge to keep it concealed and to confess. Maybe there were answers in great literature, but I discovered in Kosha's absence, in the depths of my sorrow, that the answer, all answers, the explanation for good and evil, lay in medicine. I believed that. I was sure that only if I believed would Ghosh be freed. On the third week of Ghosh's abduction, I walked to the front gate in the morning, just as St. Gabriel sounded the hour, which was Gibru's command to allow entrance. The narrow pedestrian opening permitted just one person at a time to come through. What prevented chaos and a stampede was the sight of Gibru in his priest's garb. Two men jostled each other, high-stepping over the frame of the gate like hurdlers. "Behave yourself, for God's sake!" Gibru admonished. Next came a woman who stepped over gingerly, as if getting out of a boat and onto the dock. As the patients took turns to peck like hens around the four points of Gibru's handheld cross, once for the crucified Christ, then for Mary, then once for all the archangels and the saints, and then for the four living creatures of the Book of Revelation, and waited for Gibru to touch it to their forehead, order was imposed. These visitors to missing feared illness and death, but their fear of damnation was greater. I studied the faces, each one an enigma, no two alike. I hoped that the next face would be Ghosh's. I imagined the day my real father, Thomas Stone, would step through the gate. I imagined myself standing here. I'd be a doctor by then, and I might be in my green scrubs, taking a break between surgeries, or in my white coat with a shirt and tie beneath. Even though I had no photograph or memory of Stone to go by, I'd know it was him right away. I knew what I'd say to him. You're much too late. We went ahead with our lives without you. Chapter 28 The Good Doctor. I awoke while it was not yet daybreak. I ran as fast as I could in the dark to the autoclave room. This was the thought that